That's true, but you have the Shanghai Cooperation where Iran now is member, but it's not really a security alliance.
It has a security element.
It has an element, a really security dimension, but also China doesn't really have security alliances like NATO. And the second thing would be ideology, and that's interesting. That's why the U.S. is, President Biden is trying to create this alliance of democracies. It's an ideology, like we had during the Cold War. We had the market economy.
It's almost the same language. The free world.
We had the market economy on the one hand, the democracies, the state economy and communism. So it's very similar, you're correct. And ideologies are always hypercritical, always. If you have an ideology, it was somehow hypercritical during the Cold War, and it is now.
Exactly.
Because the U.S. has very good relations with autocracies as well when it comes to geopolitical considerations.
Saudi Arabia comes to mind.
And also the Europeans, they say, we are part of this alliance of democracies. But just Chancellor Scholz was now in Saudi Arabia and then the Emirates, and because of energy, which is more important.
Democracy, except for XYZ, whoever.
Geopolitics.
Exactly.
Dominates values.
Exactly.
You can have values, but also if you look at Europe, President Biden comes to the NATO summit in Brussels.
Yeah.
He would say, we are an alliance, NATO is an alliance of democracy. The next day, the European Union comes. No, Turkey, Hungary, Poland. No, you don't share our values.
No? Exactly.
So you see, okay, it's an attempt. You know, it's
So that's very interesting, Professor, because to go back to what we were talking about initially, which is Europe. So we see this during this unipolar moment, we see this massive expansion of NATO towards the east. Some would argue, because you said geopolitics trumps values, and there are certain things that are real national interests. So we have this massive expansion. We have also in the background here the timeline of NATO expansion for our viewers. We have this, in this unipolar moment, this massive expansion to Eastern Europe, all the way to the borders of Russia with the Baltic states. And it seems to me that maybe there was the only geopolitical interest that was served here during this expansion was the American geopolitical interest, going back to the old idea of the British Empire that that Germany and Europe should never be united with Russia in any way, shape, or form, because this would create a global rival. The idea of heartland, the idea of Eurasia being strong and being a rival to the Atlantic civilization. Again, starting with the British, with Alfred Mackinder, and then later on, when the Americans become the inheritors of the British Empire after World War II, continuing this policy where you have Germany, Russia, and in the middle you have this band of buffer states who, whenever necessary for British and American interests, one day go against the Germans, the other day go against the Russians, whenever it's necessary. And of course, we see this issue. For those who are interested in history, when you had the Hitler-Stalin Pact, where this idea of these Germany and Russia, and we're not talking about the Soviet Union as a communist state or Hitler as a fascist Nazi state, but the idea that Germany and Russia would somehow come to an agreement about geopolitically, of course, immediately we see what happened then later with the Soviets and the entering the Allies against Germany. My point is simply this. We have this expansion, but it seems to me that it doesn't really serve the geopolitical interests of many of the European countries that are now part of the NATO. We have these newly liberated states from after communism with elites who maybe don't have this deeper understanding of what their long-term interest might be, being told by the West that this is so just to put away your history, to get rid of that Soviet legacy, that communist legacy, come join us. But we see now that if there's going to be a war between NATO and Russia, it is these countries that are going to suffer from it, which, of course, Ukraine being the main example. Because you talked about neutrality, and you've talked a lot about neutrality being a good option for many countries. Austria being an excellent example throughout history or modern history. If you could talk about, is it really in Europe's geopolitical interest that everybody is a NATO member all the way up to the border of Russia? Or is there thinking among some people in Europe that would look at their real interests, Germany, other countries, that it might be in their interest to have peaceful, good relations with Russia.
Many good points. I don't know whether we have the time to touch
on. No, we have the time. Sure, go ahead. We have the time.
But let's say for the NATO expansion.
Right.
Of course, I would say it was not a good idea, and many pundits warned. So it was also George Kennan who warned that some point it will have consequences, and Russia will react. That was in the 90s when he wrote Oliver. Others would say, and also we heard voices from the Soviet Union. It was not just Putin, but others, and Gorbachev and Yeltsin, and they all. They would not agree to NATO expansion, but it happened because, of course, after the end of the Cold War, Russia was pretty weak economically and had nothing really to do against it. And, of course, NATO expansion happened because it was possible.
There was no barrier to it.
Was not a barrier. And, of course, the argument is, and that's only part of the argument, that all states, it's their own decision whether they want to join an alliance, we talked about alliances, whether they join an alliance or not. So nobody should object. Also, you can find it in the OSCE documents, the Organization on Security and Cooperation in Europe, you can find it. That's the one part. But the second part is it should not negatively affect the security of other states.
Exactly.
So if you remain in the language of realism, and so we talk about the security dilemma. Security dilemma.
Yeah, exactly.
If you make a decision in your own country, it might affect the security of other states as well.
Exactly.
So that's.
Exactly.
And just think about the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it was a sovereign decision by Fidel Castro to deploy Soviet missiles here, but. Of course, the Americans are nervous. It's an understandable that
America. So now the Russians. And of course, the Americans had deployed missiles in Turkey, which was right on the Soviet border.
We can have another lecture about missile crisis. But that happened with Russia as well. But it was not only that one. I have to say, because Russia did not really have a good ideology anymore, because communism was somehow attractive to intellectuals.
Yeah, of course.
Now you have Russification, denazification, Peter the Great. They are not attractive very much.
Right.
But you have also coming from, so you have coming NATO, you're talking about the heartland. We're talking about the heartland. We have coming NATO expansion from the West. But you also, which is not mentioned that much of Russia for standing reasons, we have China coming from the east.
Yes.
We have the Belt and Road Initiative, which has a soft power. It has some ideology. It's attractive to state. It's voluntary, so that's not states are not forced.
Exactly.
Of course, it creates economic dependencies later on and might be in difficulties for some. You have to be careful if you're
One might argue that this is a natural state of countries who are not viable, who need somebody to support them.
Economically.
If they have to choose between China, who doesn't say you have to accept a base from us, and you have to, they say, okay, we'll give you, we'll build your roads, we'll build whatever infrastructure.
It's
there is attraction to
and
it.
And also, it's coming to
support your
Eastern Europe, the Balkans, the former East European states, Bulgaria, Romania.
Exactly.
So Russia is squeezed.
Yes.
And we were talking about the great power competition before.
Very good, yes.
And now Russia, so the only reason I can stay in this great power competition, economically weak anyway, with nuclear weapons, is I intervene in Ukraine to prevent further NATO expansion.
Correct.
I think it was the wrong decision, and because now NATO is coming closer to Russia with the expansion by Finland and Sweden as well. So it is more danger for Russia than it was before.
Well, maybe they figured this is the last line that they can accept even Russia, Finland, but they can't accept Ukraine.
And then you mentioned that already in your first statement. What is happening now, we have this new Cold War in Europe. We have two new bipolarities, the global bipolarity between China and US.
Right.
And US would say, we concentrate now on China.
Right.
So you Europeans work hard that with Russia, and we have this bipolarity in Europe between Russia and Western Europe. So what is happening now with the former non-aligned states, Finland and Sweden, becoming NATO members. We have the war in Ukraine. We will have a new cordon sanitaire, not only Iron right. Curtain, from the Arctic to the Black Sea. And as I predicted, it, if you look at the war situation in Ukraine, as I predict, it will go straight through Ukraine as well. Well, it's mm-hmm. the Dnieper River, or it's at the Donbass somewhere. It will be an Iron Curtain.
Right.
And it will last very long, much longer than President Putin will be in power.
Right.
We know this. The old Cold War lasted decades.
Right.
So the Europeans will have to do something about this. And if they don't want to lift this new cordon sanitaire, which was created by this great power competition, of course it was played out in Ukraine, one solution would have been neutrality. So that I wrote well before Henry Kissinger, because
right.
I wrote a piece in order to avoid in Ukraine, the best option for Ukraine would be become neutral according to the Austrian model.
So yes. that's active neutrality.
That means neutrality. I think that would have been a good idea.
We here at RRB English Radio express our sincere condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 8th of Rabiul Awwal, the martyrdom anniversary of the 11th infallible successor to the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him.
In the limelight.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's new title of Prime Minister is simply a legal cover to gain immunity from legal prosecution, according to its many critics. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Agence France-Presse tells us more about the story. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's new title of Prime Minister announced this week could prove more significant abroad than inside the kingdom, where he already wields enormous power. The appointment by royal decree comes ahead of a deadline for US President Joe Biden's administration to weigh in on whether Prince Mohammed qualifies for immunity from lawsuits filed in American courts of law. The 37-year-old de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, the world's biggest crude exporter, has been targeted in multiple such lawsuits in recent years, notably over the 2018 murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate, which temporarily turned him into a pariah in the West. His lawyers have argued in court filings that he sits at the apex of Saudi Arabia's government and thus qualifies for legal immunity. Human rights activists and government critics immediately speculated this week that making Prince Mohammed bin Salman Prime Minister was a bold-faced attempt to strengthen the immunity claim and skirt legal exposure. Sarah Leah Whitson, executive director of NGO Khashoggi-founded Democracy for Arab World Now, or DAWN, told Agence France-Presse it was a last-ditch effort to conjure up a new title for him. In other words, a title-washing ploy. In October of 2020, 2 years after Jamal Khashoggi's murder, DAWN filed a complaint in the United States along with Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, accusing the Saudi crown prince of involvement in a conspiracy that led to Khashoggi being kidnapped, bound, drugged, tortured, and assassinated. Last year, President Biden declassified an intelligence report that found the Saudi crown prince had approved the operation against Jamal Khashoggi, an assertion that Saudi authorities have denied. The legal threats to Prince Mohammed bin Salman in United States courts of law go beyond Khashoggi. He was also named in lawsuit filed by Saad al-Jabri, a former top intelligence official who fell out of favor as Prince Mohammed bin Salman maneuvered to become first in line to the throne in 2017. That complaint accuses Prince Mohammed bin Salman of trying to lure Saad al-Jabri back to Saudi Arabia from exile in Canada. Then, when that didn't work, deploying a hit squad to kill him on Canadian soil. A plot foiled when most of the would-be assailants were turned back at the border. In yet another case, Prince Mohammed bin Salman was accused by Lebanese journalist Qada Uwais of involvement in a scheme to hack her mobile device and disseminate stolen personal images to defame her and prevent her from reporting on human rights issues. The immunity question appeared to come to a head over the summer when a U.S. judge gave the Biden administration until 1st of August to say whether it believed Prince Mohammed qualified for immunity from prosecution. After Joe Biden visited Saudi Arabia in July, abandoning a previous pledge to turn Saudi Arabia into a pariah state, his administration requested an additional 60 days to decide whether to weigh in on the matter. The new deadline falls no later than Monday, 3rd of October. Britain's Guardian newspaper tells us more about the story. The Biden administration is seeking a 45-day delay in a court proceeding in which it has been asked by a U.S. judge whether it believes Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman could be granted sovereign immunity in a case involving the murder of the distant Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Representatives from the U.S. Justice Department said in a legal notice filed on Friday that the department was seeking the extension after Saudi Arabia announced in a press release last week that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had been named as Prime Minister. Critics of the Saudi government said they believed the new designation was a maneuver designed to try to establish sovereign immunity protection for the 37-year-old prince, who is facing a civil case in the United States for his alleged role in the murder of distant Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The legal case, which is being heard in a district court in Washington, D.C., had been filed against Prince Mohammed by Hatice Cengiz, Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée, and DAWN, a pro-democracy group founded by Jamal Khashoggi before he was murdered. The case has put the Biden administration in legal and diplomatic bind. The U.S. president entered the White House promising to make the Crown Prince accountable for Khashoggi's murder and to make him a pariah. But Joe Biden has already abandoned that pledge in favor of pursuing other political and foreign policy objectives. In a trip to Saudi Arabia this summer, President Biden fist-bumped the Crown Prince even after his own administration released a declassified intelligence briefing last year that concluded the Saudi Crown Prince had ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Prince Mohammed has said he has taken responsibility for the murder, but he claims he did not order the killing. The Biden administration is not formally a party to the case, but was invited to weigh in on the matter. It had been given until 3rd of October by a judge hearing the Khashoggi case to respond to a series of legal questions about whether Prince Mohammed should be granted legal immunity, which traditionally is granted to a state's ruler like a prime minister, a president, or a king. In its two-page filing on Friday, the Biden administration acknowledged it needed more time after already being granted an extension to settle the issue because Prince Mohammed's recent elevation to the role of prime minister in Saudi Arabia.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
When it comes to the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, a fourth leak has been found. That was enough for a Security Council meeting to take place. But at the end of the session, Russia was blamed for the act of sabotage. Russia and the West are trading blame over this. Although Russia has not accused the US by name, all of its statements are pointing the finger at the US. The same goes for the US and the EU. Both have stopped short of directly accusing Russia. Russia has said that the US president is obliged to answer the question of whether the US carried out its threat.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Meanwhile, Washington also dismissed the suggestion and accused Russia of spreading disinformation. While the EU has said the sabotage was deliberate, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it would be in no one's interest if the leaks were caused deliberately. But Blinken's point that it would be in no one's interest can be argued otherwise. In the case of the US, it would reap huge benefits. For example, it would continue selling gas to the EU and make huge profits. Some single shipments are bringing in $200 million for the US. The US is now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. Meanwhile, the high gas and electricity prices are pushing European manufacturers to shift to the US. This is because there are relatively stable prices in there, with green energy incentives also luring the companies to the US. The US has recently adopted Inflation Reduction Act, makes it a particularly attractive destination for companies in the chemicals, batteries, and green energy sectors. It aims to increase manufacturing and level the international playing field by using American incentives to match the competition from overseas. But what about the other parties that are related to Russia's Nord Stream pipeline, namely Russia and the EU? Would either benefit from the act of sabotage on the pipeline? The answer is a resounding no in the case of the EU. In Europe, more and more companies are switching into survival mode. For a lot of them, the time is coming to renew their electricity supply contracts with utilities. And thanks to the energy inflation, these are set to be much higher than the contracts for the current year. Meanwhile, the European Commission has promised to help by capping the revenues of oil, gas, and coal companies. As for Russia, it would lose income, so that would also be ruled out. Russia has said that Europe is now indefinitely deprived of key gas supply route. It said that it is searching for ways to get the pipelines up and running, but the timeline cannot yet be estimated. So the big winner from the energy crisis in Europe would be the US. Europe's descent into deindustrialization is happening at warp speed. With the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, there is no way back. Europe can no longer import Russian gas, and this means that prices will remain high until Europe builds more energy capacity, and this could take years. High energy prices will, in essence, make European manufacturing uncompetitive. After all, European manufacturers will be forced to pass the higher energy cost to the end user or the consumers. And that is how many European businesses will begin to unravel. According to one analyst, the only logical European response to the threat of widespread deindustrialization is to raise tariffs. This is the only way to balance out prices between more expensive European goods and cheaper foreign goods. One of the consequences, however, is that it will lower living standards, depriving Europeans of cheaper priced goods. In short, this no longer looks like a short-term crisis for Europe. Stories from Europe are like stories once heard in countries that are suffering from high inflation and resource rations imposed by the state. European companies or factories moving to the US would help the US economic situation. The US is already suffering from high inflation and an energy crunch. The relocation of European manufacturers to the United States will give the US a big advantage by boosting investment and creating jobs. It will also strengthen the country's industrial economy. This will also give the United States a bigger advantage in the face of its increasing military and economic confrontation with China. And in the face of rising competition with Russia and China, having Europe on its side will prove to be a big advantage for the United States. The question is whether the Biden administration knowingly nudged Europe to decouple from Russian energy sources in order to lure European companies toward the influence sphere of Washington.
The wait was finally over. The four regions of Ukraine are not Ukrainian territory any longer, but Russian territory, after referendums were held.
Of course, there were soldiers, but it was not because of forcing the people, but it was to protect us, and not for the people to force them to vote.
It's perfectly understandable, and on the democratic point of view, I don't see anything to say against this referendum.
The residents overwhelmingly voted to join Russia. This was the fight of their lives, said the leader of Donetsk. 3,000 days of fighting, thousands killed due to Ukraine's shelling. Now, lives will be saved. The US, the UK, and the West in general already spoke out against these referendums, which they called a sham.
Russia and the sham referenda and annexations that seem to be proceeding in Ukraine. One, we've been very clear that we are prepared and we will impose additional severe and swift costs on Russia for proceeding with the annexations.
The UK Prime Minister Liz Truss was visibly angry at Russia's formalization. Putin cannot be allowed to alter international borders using brute force. We will ensure that he loses this illegal war. For Russia, this was a big moment. First, it was successful in building a wall that almost entirely blocked NATO's eastward expansion. This would almost make Ukraine a landlocked country, posing another major challenge for Ukraine and the US. The Russian President Vladimir Putin's formalization of the referendums, however, more than just that. He took the opportunity to slam the West, the US in particular, from different angles, including cultural values. At the same time, Putin called on Kiev to return to negotiations, emphasizing, however, that Moscow will not discuss the choice made by the Donbass republics, Kherson, and Zaporizhzhia. This poses the question, is Putin open for peace talks in order to end the war? This is a question that the West, in particular the U.S. and the U.S.-backed NATO, need to wrestle with. After all, they have put all their cards in on this conflict. Looking at the U.S. assistance that Ukraine has received, the U.S. tops the list, with the U.K. coming in second. But other countries have also contributed quite a bit militarily to this war. Are they now willing to settle for a negotiated solution? A former Pentagon and CIA official has said that one theory is that Putin, aware that his military is struggling mightily against the stiff Ukrainian resistance, might use the sham boats to claim the mission is accomplished and send his troops home. This might not sit well with the West, since this, in a sense, is a declaration of a win by Putin. Yet the economic crises gripping Europe might be overwhelming for European countries, forcing them to capitulate and say enough is enough, and to opt for a compromise solution before the citizens of the countries rise up against them or protest like they did in France. Anger is rising in France over the country's deepening economic woes. Hundreds of protesters have gathered to demand higher wages and pensions. Street demonstrations were also held in other French cities in what is the first major strike since Emmanuel Macron won the re-election as president in April. Unions also called for the scrapping of Macron's plans to raise the retirement age from 62 to 65. Protesters are angry over the government's failure to live up to its promises. The unemployment rate in France inched up to 7.4% in the second quarter of 2022, from 7.3% in the previous quarter. The annual inflation rate in France eased to 5.9% in August of 2022, from 6.1% in July, but it is still higher than initial estimates of 5.8%. But France is not the only European country to experience tough economic times. Germany, which is the EU's economic powerhouse, is also experiencing a high inflation rate, which increased to a record 10% in September. The news comes after economic institutes predicted the economy to shrink next year. Soaring price of energy weighs on households and businesses. There are now concerns of widespread bankruptcies and factory shutdowns. And in the UK, Prime Minister Liz Truss is facing tough economic times. She has pressed ahead with her economic plan to cut taxes and insists that she has made the right decision. But this decision is said to make the rich have tax breaks and will increase inequality in the country and weigh down on the middle and poorer classes. The Bank of England has stepped in with a £65 billion emergency bond buying program in the UK as part of efforts to quell a market meltdown. The former governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has accused Liz Truss's government of undercutting the country's economic institutions.
Imports are obviously going to go up in price. Exporting is going to be more difficult. Added to that, the effects of Brexit, which are coming down the line straight for us. And I think we're going to be in serious trouble over the next couple of years.
I think it's obvious that there's some sort of recession coming, right? If it's not already here, we'll just have to work through it. I think, arguably, you have to keep spending to try and bring it back, but it's difficult to see. I mean, business is still there, right? The work's still happening. Everyone's still recovering from COVID, spending the money they didn't spend. So the work's still there. People are just being more frugal and a bit more considerate.
Amid widespread protests, there are now concerns of the rise of far-right groups in Europe. The grim economic outlook in Europe comes amid warnings of a looming economic recession. The head of the World Trade Organization says the world is sliding into a recession due to multiple overlapping crises. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have also downgraded their global growth forecasts. The recession is the result of a number of factors that have compounded each other. The recession has been triggered by an energy crunch, surging food prices, and bottlenecks in global trade.
The world is in a very difficult place at this time. We have a situation in which we are grappling with multiple crises. I often refer to it as a poly-crisis, simultaneous exogenous shocks hitting the world. We have security shocks. We have climate shocks. We have energy shocks. We have food price shocks. And all of this hitting countries at the same time. So we cannot afford to do business as usual.
If energy prices, if there's disruptions during winter, and the energy prices go up even further, we have a scenario in which an increase in 50% of gas prices will lead to a reduction in GDP in Europe by 1.4%. And so this is a huge number. So that means that the European economy for sure will be in recession.
Some of these factors were triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic, but the Ukraine war has made them worse. China's pandemic policies and rampant inflation have worsened the economic outlook. But investors are particularly concerned about the prospect of interest rates in the U.S.
Just as U.S. investors are completely comfortable with the Fed's strategy, there's now this concern that the rest of the world is not following on. So it's a real concern about the resolve of European central banks to fight inflation, and particularly the U.K., and how that might spread to others.
If Federal Reserve raises interest rates aggressively, the U.S. could head into a recession, which could have significant ramifications, not only for the U.S., but also its allies in Europe.
The Russian-built Nord Stream pipelines to bring gas to Europe via the Baltic Sea have sustained unprecedented damage in a single day. The pipelines burst in several locations in the exclusive economic zones of Denmark and Sweden, while neither of them was in operation amid an energy standoff between Russia and Europe. Following the explosions, a Polish politician suggested the United States was behind the sabotage of the two Nord Stream pipelines linking Russia to Germany. In his Twitter account, former Polish Foreign Minister Radosław Sikorski wrote, "Thank you, USA," while sharing a photo of the massive gas leak in the waters of the Baltic Sea. Sikorski added that, quote, "There's no shortage of pipeline capacity for taking gas from Russia to Western Europe, including Germany." The first tweet was shared thousands of times and sparked criticism against Sikorski. The Polish politician is now a member of the European Parliament. He's a former UK citizen and serves as a distinguished statesman at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies and a senior fellow at Harvard's Centre for European Studies.
It seems at one level inconceivable that the Russians would wish to damage their own pipelines in this way, particularly given that Putin has talked about Nord Stream 2 being ready to go, and why don't the Germans, you know, simply drop their ban on using Nord Stream 2 and accept the gas, since they've run short. So from that point of view, it does seem bizarre. My initial interpretation yesterday was that this was possibly an effort to signal to NATO countries, to Ukraine's allies, that Russia has this capacity. It coincided with the opening of this new Norwegian pipeline to Poland, and it's, one might say, a remarkable coincidence. If Russia has that capability and is prepared to use it, it would, of course, trigger Article 5 of the NATO treaty. And so that would be, even the threat of being able to do something like that would be a serious escalation.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
The tweets have raised speculations that Washington may have been behind the sabotage attack. It's now emerged that the CIA told Berlin weeks ago that the Russian Nord Stream infrastructure was vulnerable. On Tuesday morning, gas prices hiked further in Europe, raising concerns over the bloc's energy security. There are mounting concerns in the EU over how the continent is now going to cope with the energy crisis it's facing.
It certainly suggests that the market is in for a rough ride over the coming few months. I think there was a lot of, in recent months, prices have come down quite a lot in terms of, I mean, it's still extremely high, but down from an all-time high in late August. And I think any belief that winter was not looking that bad in terms of supply and demand, certainly been thrown out the window now as a result of the developments in the last few days.
The crisis has also highlighted the deep running dispute between the US and EU over the bloc's energy ties with Russia. For years, EU countries, especially Germany, had developed close energy ties with Russia in a bid to sustain economic growth. The United States, the bloc's main security partner, was not happy over the policy and pressured them to abandon Russia's energy sector. Washington was trying to keep the EU reliant on the US and reduce Russia's influence there. East European countries were also not happy with the deepening energy ties between Russia and the bloc. The war in Ukraine has provided a unique opportunity for the regime in Washington to pressure the EU for its own long-term strategic benefits. And the policy has come at a great cost for the European Union and its citizens. There are now concerns of a recession in the EU. Inflation is also running rampant, and discontent across the continent is historically high. Far-right parties have already made big gains in Sweden and Italy, and there are also concerns of further tilt to the right due to Europe's multiple crises. It now appears that the US is taking Europe down a path of economic and political destruction due to the Ukraine conflict.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A U.S. judge, Eileen Cannon, on Thursday, 29th of September, overruled the special master that she herself had appointed to review thousands of documents seized from Mar-a-Lago, shielding former President Donald Trump. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this news story. Please stay with us. The website Business Insider has more on this story. A federal judge, Eileen Cannon, on Thursday, 29th of September, spared former President Donald Trump and his lawyers from having to submit a sworn declaration about whether they believe the FBI inaccurately summarized the items seized from Donald Trump's South Florida home at Mar-a-Lago. Judge Eileen Cannon's ruling wiped away an early decision from the outside arbiter known as a special master she herself had appointed to review the more than 11,000 documents retrieved from Mar-a-Lago during an 8th of August search of Donald Trump's residence and private club in West Palm Beach, Florida. The special master, Senior Judge Raymond Deary, had ordered Trump's lawyers to address by 7th of October whether they contested the completeness and accuracy of the FBI's inventory of records discovered during the search. In a 6-page ruling, Judge Eileen Cannon said her order appointing Judge Deary did not contemplate that obligation for Trump's lawyers and the former president, who has repeatedly claimed without evidence that the FBI planted some of the highly sensitive documents seized from Mar-a-Lago. The decision plainly exposed power dynamics at play in the high-stakes dispute between Donald Trump and the U.S. Justice Department over records seized from the FBI's unprecedented search of a former president's home. While Judge Deary is closest to the review, Judge Cannon's decision marked a clear exertion of force over proceedings. Judge Cannon is reminding Judge Deary that the rest of us, that she is still in charge here, said Barb McQuaid, a University of Michigan law professor who served as a top federal prosecutor in Detroit during the Obama administration. She is essentially reversing Judge Deary's order requiring Donald Trump to put up or shut up about planted evidence. McQuaid told Business Insider, Judge Cannon's order permits Donald Trump to preserve that defense without any supporting facts, at least for now. Judge Deary, who was appointed to sift out records potentially covered by attorney-client or executive privilege, said Trump's lawyers could not suggest in court filings that the inventory of seized items was inaccurate without providing evidence in support of that claim. In ordering the sworn declaration, Judge Deary wrote, "This submission shall be Donald Trump's final opportunity to raise any factual dispute as to the completeness and accuracy of the detailed property inventory." Donald Trump filed a lawsuit on 22nd of August demanding that Judge Cannon appoint a special master to review records seized from Mar-a-Lago. In her time presiding over the case, Judge Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee confirmed in 2020, has drawn criticism over rulings that legal experts have seen as showing unusual solicitude to the former president. Website Salon.com has more on this story. Judge Eileen Cannon on Thursday, 29th of September, overruled the special master she appointed herself to review thousands of documents seized from Mar-a-Lago, shielding former President Donald Trump from addressing his claims that documents may have been planted or declassified in court. Judge Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee in Southern Florida, issued an order extending the timeline of the review after Trump's lawyers objected to the expedited schedule laid out by Special Master Raymond Deary, who was chosen from a list proposed by Trump's lawyers. Under the new order, the review and any surrounding issues around Raymond Deary's rulings will almost certainly stretch into next year, according to the website Politico. Judge Eileen Cannon, who has served on the bench for less than 2 years, also overruled Raymond Deary, a Reagan appointee who has served for 36 years, on his requirement that Donald Trump assert whether the FBI's inventory of seized items is accurate, effectively challenging his public claim that FBI agents may have planted evidence. There shall be no separate requirement on plaintiff at this stage, prior to the review of any of the seized materials, to lodge ex ante final objections to the accuracy of defendant's inventory, its descriptions, or its contents. The court's appointment order did not contemplate that obligation, Judge Cannon wrote. She wrote that if any issues rise during the review that require reconsideration of the inventory or the need to object to its contents, the parties shall make those matters known to the special master for appropriate resolution and recommendation to this court. Judge Cannon also rejected other parts of Raymond Deary's plan for the review, giving Trump's lawyers additional weeks to assert whether they believe any documents are covered by attorney-client privilege or executive privilege. If Judge Cannon was going to continue calling every ball in Donald Trump's favor, I'm not at all sure why she felt the need to appoint a special master to review the documents the government seized from Mar-a-Lago, tweeted Joyce Vance, a former U.S. attorney. No real surprises here. The name of the game is delay. Judge Cannon countermanded Judge Deary's streamlined schedule and helped Donald Trump advance his usual delay game in litigation. That means it could be late December before the Department of Justice can use documents it recovered from Mar-a-Lago. Judge Cannon previously came under criticism for repeatedly siding with Donald Trump in the case. Cannon's initial order barred the Justice Department from continuing its criminal investigation into the documents and ordered documents marked classified to be included in the special master review and shared with Donald Trump's lawyers. A federal appeals court overturned those rulings, arguing that she had abused her discretion and that Donald Trump was not even attempted to show that he has a need to know the information contained in the classified documents.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. We should never forget the importance of right action and just rely on uttering nice words and thinking nice thoughts. Therefore, forgiveness means to heal the wounds of the human soul. By mending these tears, the human being attains perfection. This means that forgiveness is something that we should strive for, something we should compete to obtain, and something we should hasten towards. Divine forgiveness is very important. Divine forgiveness is not something that God bestows arbitrarily, according to whim or caprice. He does not make someone the object of his kindness unless that person has striven to become worthy of that kindness and hasten towards your Lord's forgiveness and a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth prepared for the God-weary. Sometimes we might say someone belongs in paradise or that they will definitely go to paradise, and we sincerely hope that we are people destined for paradise. In all of our supplications, we ask Allah to grant us paradise. And sometimes we are not content with merely asking for paradise.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We count out the blessings we want from it one by one. We ask Allah for the Hurul Ain, for its food, the meat of its birds, and the like thereof. However, it is none other than Allah Himself who says that this paradise is for those people who have taqwa. This feast has been prepared especially for them, and only they will enter this place and sit at this table. So if we want to enjoy this feast, we too must be people of taqwa. Who are the people of taqwa? Prepared for the God-weary. Pay close attention to the words of these verses. Prepared for the muttaqin means those who have taqwa. Who are those who have taqwa? Those who spend in ease and adversity. Those with taqwa are those who spend, infaq. To spend is a condition of having taqwa. And what does spending in this sense of infaq mean? This is something we have discussed in earlier lessons. But there is no problem in repeating it here so that these words become engraved upon your hearts. Infaq is more than spending in the ordinary sense of the word. To spend ordinarily means that a person spends some money for some reason. Infaq is also spending, but it is not just any kind of spending. Allah.
We here at Arabi English Radio express our sincere condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 8th of Rabiul Awal, the martyrdom anniversary of the 11th infallible successor to the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Energy, housing, and soaring prices across the board. Britain's cost of living crisis is worsening and people are suffering. Giovanni and his wife are two of over 1,000 protesters greeting the Conservative Party conference here in Birmingham.
They don't care about ordinary people. They just want to hold on to power and maximise their own purses and get as much money out for themselves as they possibly can. It's despicable.
Conservative Prime Minister Liz Truss's government has nailed its colors to the mast. Tax cuts favoring the rich, business enterprise zones, and billions to slow the rise of household energy bills, which have gone up again this week. But all of it uncosted, sending the markets into a meltdown. How will British taxpayers afford it?
People are absolutely terrified about what's going to happen to their mortgages. They're terrified about their energy bills. They're terrified about, generally, the cost of living. And yet, at the same time, for those on over £150,000 a year, they're going to get much better off as a result of this.
The PM has pledged her government will keep an iron grip on national finances as part of her commitment to sound money. The subtext, looming cuts to already struggling public services.
They always say that we've got to pay the price for their problems. They created these problems. They create the wars, they create the shortages, and then workers are meant to pay for that and divide ourselves amongst each other. We're not going to have that.
But Liz Truss and Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng say they're determined to hold their nerve, promising a medium-term fiscal plan and independent analysis. Not now, but in November. As Birmingham hosts the conference, the Welsh and Scottish administrations have demanded a crisis summit, while the Labour Party, now with a 33-point lead in the polls, says a government appointed solely by party members has no mandate.
The UK is in a financial crisis. Protests such as this one are drawing more and more people onto the streets nationwide, meaning the pressure on this government to deliver beyond the conference walls is reaching boiling point.
Liz Truss has never had a problem charming the party faithful, but it won't be just her allies watching. Grassroots pressure is rising. Change is on the horizon. Saeed Poreza, Birmingham.
Afghanistan is still reeling from Friday's bomb attack in a Shia neighborhood in Kabul that left dozens of people dead and scores of others wounded. One of the victims of the attack was 18-year-old Najiba, whose family is grieving her loss. Najiba's father says he had raised his daughter with great difficulties, but lost her in the blink of an eye.
I've had a great passion in educating my children. I'm illiterate, but love to see my children educated. However, I'm an ordinary worker, but I always supported them throughout their school with everything they needed. My daughter